Hello and welcome to the Racing Post front page, looking back at all the hot topics from the sport of horse racing. This week we'll be looking back at York, the Ebor Festival and some of the big talking points from the week. I'm joined in the studio by Maddie Playle. Maddie, did you enjoy last week at York?
Yeah, loved it. Was very invested in the racing. Thought there were some fantastic performances from horses and jockeys and some really interesting talking points as well.
And a special mention to Scott Burton joining us all the way from France via video link. Scott, did you enjoy watching the Ebor Festival overseas?
I did actually, James. It was a fantastic 4 days of racing. It frequently is. And lots and lots and lots to talk about there. And also outside of what's happening away from the racecourse as well.
Yeah, thanks for that, Scott. Plenty to get through. And before we get stuck into some of the big talking points, it's time to tell you about all about our free bets offer. Over £200 worth of offers you can get in free bets and more here. Okay, and we're going to start this week with four fantastic days at the Knavesmire. It was the Ebor Festival, one of the greatest flat meetings of the season. And Maddie, to tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, what needs to be said, really? First off, Frankie Dettori. We keep saying it, every big meeting there is, he keeps dominating it. We saw on Wednesday with Mostadaf in the Jubmont International. Paddington was a red-hot favourite, but Frankie thought, absolutely no, we're not going with that script. I'm going to take the ball by the horns, dictate the pace, and make the race my own, and... you know, went clear of Lester Piggott with the jockey for the most wins in the race. And then on Saturday, just remarkable. I could barely believe my eyes watching it, to be honest. The winnable Kinross was probably expected, you know, in that City of York. He's one of the best 7 furlong horses, if not the best 7 furlong horse in the world. Also a Group 1 winner over 6. And Frankie knows him so well. It was that magnificent afternoon for Rafe Beckett and Mark Chan with two other big winners elsewhere across the country. But yeah, Kinross did the business in the City of York. More on that in a moment. And then Absurd. Well, he was well named, judged by the difficulty he gave Frankie down to the start. Looked mulish, didn't look interested at all. Broke from stall 24. Once again, it was Frankie Dettori ploughing a lone furrow, or nearly, with Ryan Moore on Real Dream. And then somehow, after being overtaken in the straight, managed to get back up and win the big handicap. And he was saying beforehand, oh, it's going to be difficult. I wasn't expecting anything. These things, they just seem like they're written for Frankie Dettori in his final season, don't they? But listen, a lot of people are used to hearing about Frankie now. And I think for me, one of the great things about last week was hearing about people that we don't usually hear from. How great was it to see good old Ropey Guest win and enjoy his big day in the sun for the Margesons? Rosie, who is a regular, obviously, in this office, and we see her out and about looking after Chubby, as he's affectionately known. I thought that just painted the sport in such a brilliant light. So much enthusiasm. It was fantastic. And then Scott actually deserves kudos, because this time last week, he teed up Sean Kiran for me, and I gave the jockey a ring on Monday. Just lost his claim. First ride in a Group 1, living the dream. What a great opportunity, I thought. Let's see what he has to say. And I must say, one of the most enjoyable interviews I've done in a while. Incredibly articulate.
And he told you exactly what was going to happen, didn't
he? Did. He literally told me exactly what he was going to do. He was quite confident. He wasn't... you know, overly confident, but he said, look, this horse, the way we ride him, he says, it feels like he teleports out the gates, he's that quick. We'll try and nick a few lengths at the start, we'll go forward, we'll be aggressive and see if he can last out. And that's exactly what he did. Fantastic for the Epsom trainer, Adam West. Lee's column in today's paper, all about what a gem Epsom is, and I couldn't agree more. And also for the Delemos family, great to hear their side of things and how racing's helped them through a really tough time. Just so refreshing. And could it be, here's a question for you both, that next year, or even in the years to come, we have an additional Group 1 at that meeting? Because Rafe Beckett was very keen that the City of York become a top-level race. It's got the prize money. This year it had the field, you would think, to put it into that category. And it seems like there is a real clamouring for that as part of the top 7 furlong programme in this country. We don't have a 7 furlong Group 1. How long will we be able to say that for?
Yeah, very interesting. Lots to get through. I think Living the Dream was probably the story of the week, wasn't it?
I mean, screaming at the TV, James. Absolutely screaming. I spoke to Sean Curran once and I thought I was very invested in that.
Yeah, and as you say, a huge result for Epsom. I spoke to a couple of the Epsom trainers yesterday and they were sort of saying how Epsom was once the great home of flat racing. You know, Winston Churchill had horses there. It's 600 horses at time. Loads of top trainers. Eclipse was trained in Epsom. It's an amazing story. And I mean, how good is it when you have a result like this, not just for racing, but wider sport, when you have a real underdog come through? It's fantastic, isn't it?
And I don't think there was any fluke about it. You know, this is a horse who, okay, no one was necessarily expecting it, but he ran a real cracker in the Palace House at the start of the season, decent race in the Temple Stakes, and conditions would have just really, really suited him. You know, Jason Hart was saying, Highfield Princess, no excuses whatsoever. We know York's 5 furlongs on very quick ground is one of the fastest in the country. Okay, not as quick as at Epsom, but that sort of brazen early speed is what won the race. The sectionals made for very interesting viewing, and I was just delighted to see it, to be honest.
Yeah, that was probably the story of the week.
And still only 4, we should say.
Yes,
so
of course.
This horse should have more improvement in him. He's not huge. They did it. Sean said that. He said, look, we didn't expect him to improve from 3 to 4, and he did. So his gait speed is what sets him apart. I think he'd be very hard to beat at the Breeders' Cup. We've had success in that race in recent years, obviously Glass Slippers as well. It's just so exciting.
And trainer said he'd be better on the turn as well. So really exciting prospect. We'll come to you, Scott. The Judmonton International, Mostardaf beating Paddington. Paddington having another race, probably one too many. Talk that everything is a possibility about him going to the Arc. That's a really interesting prospect. What did you make of the Judgment, Scott?
It was a fascinating race in prospect, even with the four runners before, and a little bit like Maddie with Sean Curran. I had a chat with Angus Gold about how the racing manager for Shadwell, obviously Mostardaf, he was already the joint second highest rated horse in the world on turf before Wednesday's race. Angus was very, very complimentary about Paddington, said he was a huge fan of the horse, and he said he didn't think there was any great trick to getting him beaten. You just have to be the best horse on the day. It transpires that this conversation that was had with Angus, Shaka Hissa was involved. Richard Hills obviously was a huge part of the operation when he was the retained jockey to Shaka Hamdan for many years, and is now Angus's number two. Frankie, John Thady Gosden, they all kind of had a kind of council of war on the day before the race, Tuesday, and came up with this plan to try and make the running. Largely based around the idea that because Paddington was getting away for age, if it turned into a sprint, just that weight advantage would be the difference. And that they had to kind of make Mostardaf's class tell over each one of the 10 furlongs. It was obviously brilliantly executed. You'd probably say that Paddington didn't quite run up to the form he showed, say, in the Eclipse or even the Sussex Stakes, because on the figures he probably shouldn't have finished behind Nashua. But it was just a brilliant horse race when it came down to it.
Yeah, it was. And Scott, we know you like your French racing, obviously French correspondent, but you also like your Japanese racing as well, I'm inclined to believe. That's quite a boost for Equinox, isn't it, what he's done this season?
I feel sure that if the international handicappers could have another bite at the 129 they gave Equinox for winning the Shima Classic, they'd probably do so. And I know Maddie was there as well. He was jaw-droppingly good that day. And if you look at what's happened with the horses that finished behind him, Westover was second. We all know what a fantastic season he's had. Mostardaf kind of put it up to him, didn't probably quite stay, but still now come out and won a Prince of Wales is and a Judmont International. Just you go back through that the form of that race. Zagreb was third. He ran a very, very good race behind Westover on his comeback in the Grand Prix de Saint-Cloud, and we'll be seeing him in Group 1 company. I think he goes to Germany next weekend for the Grosse Prize. So it's a form line that just keeps on repeating. And the irony is that if the international handicappers decide to give an extra pound or two to either Mostardaf or Hookham, they could end up by the end of the year as a better horse than Equinox. But Angus Gold described him as a monster when I spoke to him on Monday, and I can't think of a better description. He's just a of almost a different species, and he'll be running in Japan this autumn, taking all three or at least two out of the Tenno Shorts and the Japan Cup and the Arimekinen, and I think he'll be spectacular to watch wherever he rocks up.
Maddie, did he seem like a monster to you?
Yes, absolutely. Got to be one of the most spine-tingling, thrilling performances I've seen live when he won the Shima
really?
Classic. Yeah, absolutely. And just to look at as well, the buzz was there for him in the week, in the build-up. He knew he was special, and he just beat proper Group 1 horses like they were standing still. Scott probably gets annoyed because every other week I'm asking him, I'm like, what do you know is the latest on Equinox? And hopefully there's a chance he could stay in training next year. And I think we're seeing, obviously, the ARC is the race that the Japanese really want to win. Equinox isn't even entered this year, and their squad for the race seems quite quiet. But we must remember, not every ARC is run on bottomless ground. And I think, who's to say, even if they did get soft ground, then you know, Equinox couldn't handle it. He's that good. But if you got a relatively sound surface in October for this horse, I think he would be above and away the best chance that Japan will probably ever have in my lifetime of winning the ARC.
Yeah, fantastic. I've got a really interesting question for you both. Fascinated to hear what you see of this one. So Frankie Dettori had a fantastic week, as we know. He had a really, really flying form. Mosterdaf was a great ride. Absurd was incredible. But there are a couple of little clues that it might just not be his farewell year. So after winning on Mosterdaf, John Gosden said, "You never know. He might be back next year. You never know. He's certainly enjoying his big last year." And after Absurd won at York on Saturday, Frankie Dettori, first and foremost, was very eager to try and secure himself a Melbourne Cup ride, the one race. I think he wants to win more than ever. But he said after York, "I've put it out there, but the phone is still silent. If a big offer comes, I might consider it." So there are some clues that perhaps it isn't a farewell year. Maddie, look into that crystal ball. Have we got another year, Frankie?
It's funny, isn't it? It's initially the story has been, no, definitely retiring at the end of the year. It's great, I'm really enjoying it, but definitely retiring at the end of the year. And then as time goes on, and these, I mean, it really is incredible, these successes keep happening. You're just getting a sense of whether he's having a bit of fun with us all and winding us all up, I don't know.
Which is very frankly.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there is probably a sense of he's like, well, hang on, if I'm doing this good and I'm enjoying it that much, you know, come at me, give me the offers, and then I can make a decision rather than no way, it's all off the table. But I do sense there is a little bit of playing a game with us. And I think knowing Frankie and how he wants his legacy to be, to have this big farewell tour and then to come back, it's almost like you're building towards a bit of an anti-climax. I would like to see him go out on the top.
Yeah, Scott, that's a very clever way of trying to get some good rides, isn't it, from Frankie there, I think, isn't it?
Certainly is. I mean, his kind of farewell was supposed to be he would finish in Britain on Champions Day and then he would go to the Breeders' Cup and that would be it. He's obviously fishing for rides. He's now clearly got one with Absurd, assuming that William Mungus doesn't offer him Vauban. I don't, you know, that obviously depends on Ryan Moore's availability. He might have a very, very difficult choice to make there. So Melbourne's on the cards. Mark Chan had made it very clear even before the weekend that he wanted him to come to Hong Kong for the Longines Hong Kong International Races to ride Kian Ross in the mile. We should just say, what a exciting horse Kian Ross might be going forward in the autumn. Speaking to Ray Beckett yesterday, he's in just about everything except the boat race, and he's probably going to run a minimum of another four times between now and December.
Wow.
So he could. I think that he's in the Park Stakes in Doncaster. If it came up soft, they would probably go to Haydock for the Sprint Cup. The Prix de la Forêt is one of the main targets. Again, he could go back to Ascot to defend his title in the Champion Sprint. They definitely want to go to Santa Anita for Breeders' Cup Mile, and then, as I say, finish off at Chartin as well. So that already takes you to the middle of December. I wouldn't take short odds about him turning up on I'm a Celebrity if he's going to be in Hong Kong weekend of December, and then we'll see after that. I mean, you know, maybe Bob Baffert calls up and says, "Come and ride another winter at Santa Anita," and it all goes around again. One thing we should mention while we're just looking back at York, obviously, and it would be the one that got away as far as Frankie's concerned, but we should mention the Yorkshire Oaks.
And yes, of course.
He just touched off free win when Frankie got caught in a bit of a pocket, but it's a superb ride from James Doyle, who I consistently think is one of the most underrated big race jockeys around, and obviously has a fantastically good job as number two to William Buick at Godolphin. There's probably less need for that this year. They're having a bit of a quiet year anyway. But Warm Heart, I thought, actually put in a really, really good performance as well, and I think she'll be interesting to see. They were talking about potentially, because she likes quick ground, maybe the Breeders' Cup for her. So she'll be interesting to follow elsewhere. But no, he likes to keep us guessing, doesn't he? And all the time he's winning these big races. I mean, I was when he had his final ride and his final win on Inspiral in the Jacques Mara Marowal the other 2 weeks ago, I think it was his last ride in Dover. Then all the French jockeys came out and gave a sort of reception, and Yves Saint Martin was there to congratulate him and all the rest of it. And you could see it was beginning to get to him a bit emotionally.
Yeah, it looked it on the TV as well.
He's going through these kind of, the closer it gets. I mean, it's now, what, we're probably only 8 weeks, are we, to Champions Day at Ascot, something like that. Time's running out on his career in Britain, which is where he's made the vast majority of his big race wins. So even with all these international farewells coming up, it's becoming very real to him, really. And I think probably winning races like the Ebor and the International for another time, I think they're extra special when you think they might be the last time. So more to come, surely.
Yes, so Frankie Dettori, we will not know until later in the year. But from one jockey who could be retiring to one who definitely has, but more after that after you hear about our Members Club offer.
Are you ready to take your passion for horse racing to the next level? With Racing Post Members Club, you gain exclusive access to the best racing insights, analysis and tools. Immerse yourself in award-winning content, from interviews with the sport's biggest stars to race previews and behind-the-scenes features. Get the inside track with early access to the Racing Post digital newspaper from 9 p.m. in the evening and daily selections from our expert tipsters. Racing Post Members Club is your ultimate ticket to the thrilling world of racing. Subscribe today and pay just £9.99 per month for the first 2 months with the code SUMMER. See the link in the video description for more information. Terms apply.
So on Friday, Paul Hannigan retired from the saddle at the age of 42. He's had over 2,000 wins, won two champion jockeys title and a champion apprentice title in his younger days. But his career has come to an end, and what a career it was. So we look back on really one of the great riders of a modern day, a two-time champion jockey, 191 winners, his best season in that time, and many a Group 1 winner. He had time as Shadwell's number one, of course, riding horses like Togruder, Muhura, Mukadram. Some of the great wins include, with Togruder, was the Oaks, the King George, finished third in the Ark, of course, to the great Trev. And, of course, with Muhura, he was the champion sprinter in a wonderful season, winning the Commonwealth Cup, July Cup and many more races. It's been an interesting career in the saddle for Paul. His career almost ended at one point when he had a very bad back injury at Newcastle in 2020. But a few months later, he was back in November. Quite extraordinary. He broke three vertebrae. But later that season, he was back to ride his 2,000th winner, a remarkable achievement. There's been some really ups and downs along the way here. One story I picked up is that he missed rides at Carlisle one day because his hand was badly injured from a wasp sting. Worth having a look at that old story if you can find it. The pictures are pretty extraordinary. He's had some challenges too. He split with Sheikh Hamdan in 2016. He split with Richard Fahey in 2022. And perhaps the biggest challenges came in recent times when he rode the Riddler to win the Norfolk Stakes at Royal Ascot. It was a hugely controversial ride, and it was this week last year where Paul Hannigan wrote about the interference case, which saw him get a 10-day ban for careless riding, saying that that should be the catalyst of change for interference rules in Britain. And the BHA are still currently working on that rules, we've heard, and they're expected to reveal some changes perhaps to interference and running and riding in Britain later this year. So we'll look back on a fantastic career for Paul. Maddie, I mean, a great jockey. He's been around for a long time, since the early sort of 90s, his first rides. I mean, he's been one of the great, for me and you, sort of getting into racing. He's been there, hasn't he, for a long time and at a very, very high level.
Yeah, very consistent rider. I always thought very strong in a finish. That's one of the qualities I admired in watching Paul Hannigan ride. But if I'm being honest, James, I think, and the reaction to this news last week that really strikes me about this is just how well-liked Paul was. Very popular member in the weighing room and also among the press. Just a really lovely guy, and I think he's a credit to himself and his family that he's managed to get where he has from, you know, not a racing background. You know, he's very much saying, you know, working class lad, brought up near Warrington, never thought that he'd have anything like the career that he has, and I think that's testament to all the years of hard work and graft that he put in, but also to his skill. One of the memories that sticks out for me when I was only, I think, 16 at the time, was watching Mukadram win the Eclipse. Just one of those really lovely older horses who was really building towards something, and that was his big day in the sun. Paul, very prominent on him, just kept things very straightforward. Again, something that I think Paul was brilliant at. You know, sat behind the pace, unleashed him, kept him going in the final furlong, and he just seemed to build up a really good rapport with a couple of those Shadwell horses. A bit of a shame that it couldn't have gone on for a little bit longer. But
yeah, 4 years in total, I think it was.
You know, Paul just clearly has some very well-established relationships in racing. We mentioned Richard Farr. He obviously still had that relationship with Shadwell for 4 years. And I think that just goes to show, you know, what an incredibly likeable professional person he was.
Yeah, and it does speak volumes, doesn't it, that the Riddler case last year, it was such a huge story. It was such an obvious problem. And to come out and write in his Racing Post column that he wants that to be make interference better. I mean, some of the lines in that column was that he spoke about jockeys pushing boundaries, that they could get away with things and they could. It was sort of this way of thinking, it's go all in to win. And of course, one of the things, that problems with the sport, is that it can take a bad incident for something to change. But for him to be on that appeal, which he won, of course, and he said in the column that he thinks the right verdict was made, but that the culture needs to be changed. To come out and say that, it's quite bold, isn't it?
I really think it is. And jockeys, you know, they live quite an insular life in many ways. It's a very tough lifestyle. And for him to see the bigger picture and see beyond that one specific incident and speak so eloquently and give a commentary on the safety and the fairness of race riding overall, again, just speaks volumes to his character and his professionalism. And he's got a new role now, I believe, but I'm sure he will still be involved on the race courses. And you know, whether that be coaching, I don't know, but I think he's clearly got very valuable input, and racing would be remiss to not take advantage of that.
Yeah, and just on the interference, to bring you in here, Scott, I mean, it's obviously very, very different in France. I mean, have you got a strong opinion on the way the rules are for interference here? And do you agree with a lot of what Paul was saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that is long overdue, and I know the BHA are taking a very sort of evidence-based approach to it. There's a certain amount of ire within the organisation when the British interference rules are portrayed as being, you know, kind of win at all costs, and basically you've got to commit murder to get chucked out and all the rest of it. I think we have probably seen a bit more willingness, even under the current rules, in the last couple of years, for stewards to turn results around and then leave it to the appeal to actually have a proper amount of time to look at it. A lot of them do, probably, that wouldn't have got chucked out 2 or 3 years ago, now possibly do, with the idea that the on the day stewards have got that kind of fallback of the appeal, because if a result gets changed, it's almost certain, unless it's a really, really clear-cut case of really serious interference, that the injured party, as it were, the first past the post, will appeal it. So they have that kind of fallback position, as it were. I am personally of the opinion that they do need to be tightened up. I think it's an incredible disincentive to owners who have racehorses who already are not getting, you would say, a fantastically good financial return for their investment. People sort of take the view that from a bookmaking point of view and a punting point of view, people want clarity and they want the first past the post paid out. But actually, I think if you look at the owner's perspective, if you have a horse that suffers serious interference, finishes second or third in a big race, a big Saturday handicap or a race at Royal Ascot or wherever, and you don't feel you've had a fair chance to win that race because the first past the post won by two lengths and therefore it's probably not even been looked at by the stewards, or if it has, they are so minded to kind of lean towards the first past the post. I think that's a huge disincentive. And I think, even with my sort of French hat on, if you like, the French interference rules were changed back in about 2017 to be more in line with what they call the Category 1 interference rules, which is the way things are adjudicated in Britain, Ireland, Australia, Hong Kong, and now even Japan have changed as well. We used to have a lot more demotions here, and the idea was to have fewer stewards inquiries in the first place and fewer results changed. There's still a way of doing that where you put the onus on jockeys to ride straight, to not put each other in danger. And I think those rules do need to be adapted. I think it speaks volumes of what a not just a jockey, but what a man Paul is, for him to be able to say, under the current rules, it was absolutely right that we kept the race and that there was no change to the order and I just served my punishment. But that, I'm going out, my colleagues are going out day in, day out, and we feel that there is unnecessary additional risk involved in race riding because of where the line in the sand is, and everybody rides up to it because everybody is trying to win. And I think it would help jockeys to have stricter rules on interference. And I think they would possibly lead marginally safer lives as well, which has to be a good thing.
Yeah, sure. So just to clarify, Tim Naylor, the BHA's Director of Integrity and Regulation, said a consultation is ongoing and likely for something to change at the end of the year. And Scott, back to Paul, I mean, is there a Hannigan highlight, perhaps one from your time in France?
Certainly, Mohara winning the Maurice de Guest was a big day. I remember Paul being absolutely thrilled, Charlie Hills as well. He was on a kind of quite a roll at that point. He'd won the Commonwealth Cup, and you never really quite know at that stage how good the three-year-old sprinters are going to be, but he beat them up quite badly that day. I know, listening to Richard Fye being interviewed somewhere or other the other day, that he looked back to Wooden Bassett's win in the 2010 Jean-Luc Lagardère, the big two-year-old colts race on Arc Day, as the first win of his career that made him feel like he'd properly arrived as a proper racehorse trainer. And I feel sure Paul will probably look back very fondly with that. And look, Wooden Bassett's, everybody who's ever touched that horse has made money. So you look at what he's doing at stud now. He's obviously a very important horse for everybody. I think the other thing that stands out to me is, to be champion jockey based in the north is an incredibly hard thing to do. I think there's a very, very small number of people who've ever achieved it, certainly since the 1800s anyway. But what Paul's pursuit of the championship actually led to him being appointed as Hamdan's number one. He obviously would have ridden largely on the northern circuit. And when he actually made his title challenge, he was going down to places like Goodwood and Ascot, and Sandown much more regularly in search of good rides. His agent was getting him rides he was building up a lot of contacts with a lot of southern-based trainers. And I don't think there's any chance that Shadwell would have looked at him if he hadn't had that experience of those big grade one tracks in the south. And so what it sort of shows is, we kind of think of the chase to be champion jockey as something that kind of almost comes at the expense of quality, even if you've got a William Buick and a Sheen Murphy chasing the title. But actually, Paul going after the title, it opened up the biggest job of his career, and he would not have won an Oaks without and a King George on Tagaria with that. So it's a different way of looking at things, but an incredibly effective jockey, very, very popular in the weighing room, and I'm sure he'll be as successful whatever he goes on to do.
Yeah, indeed. So many good times with Paul Hannigan. He's retired from the saddle. Okay. And it's on to our third and final story. And it's to you, Scott, in France, to talk about a story in Ireland.
Yes, it's the progress or lack thereof of the Irish Gambling Regulation Bill. Obviously, viewers in Britain will have been following the twists and turns of the various different stages of the White Paper to reform the Gambling Act in Britain. But Ireland is going through a similar scenario, and we've heard from a lot of different people in the last 10 days, 2 weeks, who are rightly very, very concerned about the potential impact of Part 6 of the bill, which is one which proposes that there will be a ban on all gambling advertising on all television and online between 5:30 in the morning and 9 at night. It doesn't leave a great deal, obviously. I think we first heard from Paul Nolan, Cheltenham Festival winning trainer, on behalf of the trainers in Wexford, talking about this 2 or 3 weeks ago, saying that Racing TV and Sky Sports Racing had both come out and said that it won't be financially viable for them to screen Irish racing in Ireland if there is this ban on advertising. Obviously, a good deal of their income comes from bookmakers' advertising. They described it as ill thought out and having a big financial effect. Well, we've heard from a lot more people in the last, as I say, 10 days. Notably, one of the, Paul Kehoe, who's a deputy also from Wexford, seems to be the kind of geographical centre of this, who said that he completely understands racing's concerns and that he would like to see a carve out for the satellite stations, for the non-terrestrial stations, so that whereas Virgin and RTE and TG4 would have to abide by this advertising ban, that Racing TV and Sky Sports, if they ever got back into the Irish arena, would be exempt from that. He said he felt that it was important for the finances of racing, and that it would be a very detrimental thing to the industry. Obviously, racing is worth an incredible amount to the Irish economy through tax revenue, through sales of bloodstock, internal investment. You think of a number of major jumps owners who now have their horses in training who are British-based, but have their horses in training with Willie Mullins or Gordon Elliott or Henry de Bromhead or any of the other top trainers there. There are lots and lots of knock-on effects that this could have. I spoke to Peter Maloney, who manages Kenny Alexander's string and is also closely related with Qatar Racing on the flat. And he drew the comparison with show jumping, which he and I are about the same age. I remember show jumping being huge on the television in the 1970s and 1980s. And he said specifically, in an era when Ireland's place on the world sporting stage probably wasn't what it is now, the feats of Eddie Mackin and Paul Barrow and Captain Tom Power made them national heroes. And when show jumping disappeared from television, just it went out of fashion and other things became available to show. When television went out of fell out of favour with show jumping, it became a very much restricted sport. And he talked about the Royal Dublin Show the other week, the Nations Cup team, nobody in the street would know who was riding for Ireland. So his fear is that a similar kind of diminution of the sport could happen if it disappears from those satellite racing channels. I mean, even the state broadcaster RTE at this point still carries gambling advertising and have said that they will do right up until the point where they're forced to not by any legislation. So it's an ongoing struggle. The political scene in Ireland seems to be one where there's quite broad support across the parties. There's a coalition government, three-party coalition government in the Republic. There seems to be quite a lot of support for this. So Paul Kehoe's comments probably very, very welcome at this point. Again, Peter Maloney told me there's a lot of work going on in the background, but to actually have members of the Dáil come out and say that this needs to be looked at is incredibly important, because if the various different political parties all think that this is a popular move and that it's just racing making its case and that nobody else really cares about it, you know, politicians will take the line of least resistance. And were this ban to come in, I think it's obviously going to be incredibly serious for the visibility of the sport and therefore not its finances going forward.
Yeah, of course. I'm really well gone through a really interesting topic and a quite scary prospect as well. It's probably worth mentioning that Irish breeding is such a huge business. Ireland's obviously a bit smaller than the UK, but and their breeding business is huge over there, probably almost as big as the UK, if not bigger. So the impact on the economy is going to be much bigger. And it's worth just clarifying, though, the process is now gone through the committee stages, the report stage, where amendments are being considered. So now is the time where voices are being heard, and racing really needs to be clear. The other comment we've had this week is from the Association of Irish Owners. You talked about Max McNeil and Kenny Alexander, two big British-based owners who invest in the sport, and she's saying that this is a huge deterrent to owners going to Ireland, which is such a huge business, as we've said. And more than 40 trainers have raised concerns. So it's clear that the alarm bells are ringing. Scott, is there any reason to sort of think that racing's voices are going to be heard? Are there any signs of positivity here? And what do you think is the outcome, albeit it's a very, very difficult question to ask?
You would think probably any time from 2016 onwards, you should be getting out of the prediction business when it comes to politics. But I think that there's different ways of looking at it. Looking at this from outside of the Republic of Ireland, we think of it being so intrinsically a racing nation. I'm a little bit older than you two. I can remember Charles Haughey being the Taoiseach Prime Minister in Ireland in the 1980s. Same party as the TD, who was actually moving this legislation, Fianna Fáil. And he was very famously a friend of racing, and a lot of the tax breaks that Irish breeders and Irish trainers and owners enjoy now date from the time when he was in government. But much like Chris Cook wrote in a piece looking at the British political system a couple of weeks ago in a column he wrote, very well-argued column, the traditional friends of racing in Parliament, which used to be in the Conservative Party, predominantly in Westminster, and they had obviously very good relationships with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in Ireland, they need to be almost rebuilt. Those don't exist. There's a very, very large concentration in Ireland on all things to do with safeguarding the youth. Education is a big hot button topic. Housing for young people is a big hot button topic. And the motivation for this advertising ban, according to the government, the Irish government, is to, the reason that there's even a 5:30 start is because they're aware that children get up and start watching the television early. That's where this comes from. It's less to do with statistics that would show any sort of serious increase in gambling-related harm, although that's obviously a large part of where the concern is. There's actually less of a statistical spike in that, and it's more to do with protecting children. And I think politicians will look at that and think that's the right side of an argument to be on. I think, ultimately speaking, it's a similar scenario to the one we find in Britain, is that racing has to make its case that there are huge financial consequences involved here. And then ultimately the politicians will at least have the evidence presented to them. As I say, Peter Maloney said that there are lots and lots of efforts going on in the background. As I say, Wexford seems to be the geographical nexus of all this. James Brown, who is the Secretary of State in charge of the Ministry of Justice, who is moving this legislation, is also one of the TDs for Wexford. So he and Paul Kehoe, they are technically members of the same government, although they're not from the same party. You would think it will end up on a few election flyers. There has to be an election in the Republic before February 2025, I think it is. So there's a good chance it will come next year. Will this actually make its way all the way through the Irish parliamentary system before there's an election, or will it get kicked onto the next administration? Who knows? That said, the opinion polls are being led by Sinn Féin, who have been very, very supportive of this bill and have argued, not specifically in the advertising arena, but in the arena of help for addiction services and all the rest of it, that it doesn't go far enough. So there is a broad consensus that something needs to be done here, and racing really is going to have to work overtime just to carve out this exemption for the satellite racing channels, because otherwise the financial shortfall is going to be considerable, and the notion that Irish racing fans will not be able to watch weekday racing and anything outside of the major festivals in their own country is from a horse racing point of view, a very, very serious problem.
Yeah, I think that's key. And I think one of the key points you mentioned there, Scott, is the idea of racing and gambling and the link, but also more perhaps worryingly is that casino gambling and sports betting are not being separated and treated as different entities. It's an issue that's been mentioned in the gambling consultation over in Britain, which of course we're still looking for your opinions on the affordability checks. We had an excellent letters page, very worth a read, and of course please do keep in touch on the consultation, which is ongoing. Maddie, it's a scary prospect this for Ireland, isn't it? And not just the Irish racing, but for Irish punters and for people in Britain who want to bet on Ireland, which is booming.
Yeah, it seems so extreme, doesn't it? It's really, really alarming. And I think this is another scenario where in today's society, racing is once again having to justify itself, given that it's so inextricably linked to gambling. You know, as passionate followers and people are employed by the sport, you know, we understand the nuances in gambling. And it definitely seems like there's a divide, and these topics are going to, you know, keep coming up in government. And as you say, given that this is Ireland we're talking about and how valuable our sport is in Ireland to the Irish economy.
And it's knock-on effect for the world of rating, really.
Exactly. You know, Ireland is almost the home of the thoroughbred.
Yeah.
So it's just incredibly worrying. And again, I think racing is essentially having to stand firm, justify itself, almost explain itself.
Fight for itself.
And we've got to make sure that we're getting these messages out there and you know, treading carefully and believing in what we stand for. And I think it would be an absolute massacre to Irish racing if you know, terrestrial television coverage, you know, we didn't have that between those pinch points, which don't leave a lot of room for error. So I'll be watching eagerly to see how that story develops.
Yes, and make sure to keep an eye on the Racing Post for all the developments of that story. Our team in Ireland, our top team in Ireland, will be covering that. So it now falls to me to decide what goes on the front page this week. And we'll start with the Irish gambling. I think there's been a bit of momentum, a bit of positivity, but I want more positivity, Scott, if that's going to make the front page, I'm afraid. Paul Hannigan, a fantastic career in the saddle. Very, very good career. And, I mean, plenty to look for. That Guard of Honour on Friday, I thought, was brilliant. And the pictures were fantastic. But I have to say, York on a whole, it was fantastic. You had me, Maddie, with Frankie. You had me of living the dream.
It was feel good, wasn't it? It always is.
It was racing done well, wasn't it? Fantastic prize money. Top class racing. If that doesn't go on the front page, then, I mean, we've had a lot of doom and gloom in the sport, but that was a really good 4 days. So, Maddie, well done. You've won this week.
Fantastic. Thanks, James.
Good. Well, make sure to join us next week for all the latest news from the front page. But for now, goodbye.